Listener supported. WNYC Studios.
Brian Lehrer on WNYC, and what haven't we humans done to live forever? For his new book, Adam Leith Gollner sought out all the different ways we've tried to achieve spiritual or physical immortality, with his quest taking him from a Jesuit retreat to the magician David Copperfield's private island in the Bahamas. He catalogs these pursuits in his new book, which is titled The Book of Immortality, The Science, Belief, and Magic Behind Living Forever. Adam Leith Gollner, welcome to WNYC. Thank you for joining us.
Thanks for having me.
And for those of you who know Vice Magazine, he's a former editor there. So we're all going to die, if I can stipulate that. Why did you write a book about immortality, considering that fact?
I was curious about why so many people believe in something that cannot be proven, and especially in the face of so much kind of secular data, we persist in thinking that there is something more to come, or that we can maybe find a way to prolong this physical existence indefinitely.
Is the search for immortality, in your experience, mostly a first world phenomenon? Could one make the argument that it's a luxury to even have the time to think about trying to live forever?
Well, it depends on how we define it, right? Because if we're talking about spiritual immortality, that's a universal, global phenomenon. Every culture at all times ever has always had a story about something that happens after death. As far as physical immortality concerns, that may be a problem of luxury. I mean, one of the greatest examples of a physical immortalist ideology was during imperial Chinese times, when many emperors actually consumed elixirs intended to make them live forever and then died as a result of taking these potions. Mm,
like a Twilight Zone episode. Would you argue that the desire for immortality is at the root of creative expression and the pursuit of fame? Is that just another means of living forever?
Well, there are, according to the ancient Greeks, there are three main forms of creative expression, and one of them is having children, a procreative act in which our lineage is passed on to further generations. Another way would be, as you just described, the pursuit of attaining fame through accomplishments, whether that be athletic or scientific or artistic. And then the third would be what they considered a little bit more metaphysical, which would be philosophical immortality.
Well, we're all familiar with the idea of a figurative fountain of youth, but you actually pursued what the magician David Copperfield claims is a literal fountain of youth at Musha Key, his private island in the Bahamas. You went there.
Yeah, I went and I spent 3 days on David Copperfield's private islands with him in the Bahamas. He wouldn't actually show me the Fountain of Youth, but he did agree to speak about it with me with what he called great verbal aplomb.
Are you a believer?
Absolutely.
Yeah?
At least I suspended my disbelief. I mean, that's the great beauty of magic.
Tell me about it.
Well, I mean, he claimed that there's a distinction between what he calls his puffery, meaning his illusions, his tricks, his magic shows, and discovering an actual liquid that reverses genes, as he put it. So he seemed very convincing, at least in talking about it. And he gave me something that I'm very grateful for, which is a story. Whether it's real or not is up to the reader.
So it reverses genes. So how old is he now? 12, 8, 6?
Probably older than that, but I don't know exactly how old he is.
And water, as in that story, is a recurring theme throughout your research for this book, it seems. Is water a recurring theme in the quest for eternal life?
Yeah, there's countless examples of waters of life throughout all sorts of faiths and different religions and spiritual practices. And there's something so elusive about the symbolic nature of water. It's this thing that obviously keeps us alive. We need it to stay healthy. We all need it every day. So do all forms of life. And it seems that to our ancestors, the idea occurred that perhaps water could not only keep us alive in the present moment, but perhaps indefinitely. And there's another reason why water seems to have become associated with ideas of immortality. And it's a very simple idea. It's that when you see the sun dipping into the water at the end of the day, it seems to die, and then it comes up again the next day. And so to our ancestors, that must have made us think that the same could happen to us.
Listeners, anything you want to say or ask about immortality, physical or spiritual. 212-433-WNYC for Adam Leith-Gollner, author of The Book of Immortality, The Science, Belief, and Magic Behind Living Forever. 212-433-WNYC, 433-9692, or post to WNYC.org. Click on Brian Lehrer Show. Your research also took you to a so-called 2068 party, as in the year 2068, in honor of the host's prospective 125th birthday. Who's that guy?
That guy's name was David Kekich, and I found the invitation on a forum called the Immortality Institute. And I was, at the time, researching physical immortalists and trying to see what they had to say about how they think science is going to find a way to make us live forever. And I found this invitation to a party in Huntington Beach that seemed like the perfect way to learn about this subject. The host, Dave, was saying that he was going to be celebrating his 125th birthday. And the theme of the party was in the year 2068. And so everybody had to come in period garb, in costume, the way they would dress in the year 2068, when we would all be immortal. And guests had up to 5 minutes at a time to discuss or to describe to the other guests how we had attained physical immortality.
Let me switch to the spiritual side, because many religions frame immortality as something you get in the afterlife. But that's a different immortality, obviously, than the physical kind that we've been discussing so far. Why do you think afterlife immortality figures so prominently in religions when their main job is sort of to focus on how we behave on Earth?
It really depends on how we define a religion's main job. But I think one of the things that religions provide us with are answers to the great mysteries, such as how did the universe begin? So creation myths, every important religion gives us a way of thinking about that. But it also gives us a way of visualizing death, of what death means, of making sense of the senselessness, of trying to give us a story that will help us cope with our own grief and with our own mortality. So I guess that's where religions, to me, that's one of their fundamental roles, not just helping us with our mm-hmm. our ethics and our moral behavior
yes,
while we're
clearly.
Here, but helping us make sense of death.
And did you come up with any what might be new insights into different religions' approaches to afterlife immortality or how they use it in this world?
I think one of the conclusions that I draw in this book is that belief is such a fundamental human experience. We all have a need to believe, and we often don't realize when we're believing. Beliefs have this interesting way of masquerading as knowledge. They're these mirages that provide the illusion of certainty. And so I think we all have this need, and we should be understanding of others' need to try to make sense of death. And every story that we tell about death is valid and good as long as it helps somebody cope.
And I tend to think religions use it in two ways, and I'm sure it's more complex than this. But for societies where there's a lot of poverty, a lot of despair, a lot of early death, to give people hope and something to live for, literally, because if they live a good life, then they'll get something forever after this hard scrabble life. There may be a lot of that in Hinduism, for example, with as tough as life has been for so long in India. And then on the other side, to use it for control, command and control, to instill fear rather than hope. Like, you better do what we tell you to do, or you're going to rot in hell for eternity.
It can be used in so many ways, obviously. It's such a slippery topic. Belief is so confounding. It's such a perplexing situation to find ourselves in. But I do think that alongside those two big ideas, there is also the fact that in grief, when we lose someone really close to us, it can be so overwhelming that we do turn to the stories that religions provide us with as a form of solace.
Nick in Stony Point, you're on WNYC. Hello.
Hey, Brian. How you doing?
Good.
I studied a little bit. I mean, I dabbled in like Hinduism and Buddhism, like you guys are talking about, like meditative practices.
Mm-hmm.
And I've heard stories about these yogis living in the mountains, living for hundreds and hundreds of years. Did your author research any of that, or can you tell me anything about that?
Yeah, there are some great stories about the Siddhas, I think is what they're known, who have attained some form of alchemical immortality. It seems that those stories are a tad hard to confirm. They're in the same compartment as stories about breatharians who manage to live only on breath for decades, or sun gazers who feed themselves off the sun's rays and nothing else. I mean, it's interesting. Marco Polo wrote about encountering some of those yogis who had lived for centuries while he was on the coast of India. I think that these stories have a role, again, in kind of affirming faith-based ideas of immortality. And whether they're something we want to believe in or not is up to us.
Carolyn in Manhattan, you're on WNYC. Hi, Carolyn.
Hi. There is a poem that is terrific, famous poet. I can't remember his name. And it begins with this: "To desire immortality is to weep on your own grave." And it ends with this: "And the punishment is fixed, to be cast in bronze for a city square and dribble green in times of rain." That's it.
Enough said.
Yeah, that's funny. I was just writing a piece for the Paris Review, and I was writing about Ovid's idea of attaining immortality through verse, and I came across an image of a supermarket in upstate New York called Ovid Supermarket.
Carolyn, thank you. By the way, if anybody knows that quote and can tweet us the poet, @BrianLehrer, or call in line, and our producer will just feed it to me, 212-433-WNYC. We should give credit there if we can. Alan in Montgomery Township, New Jersey, you're on WNYC. Hi, Alan.
Brian, how are you today? Love your show, love the channel, love everything about it.
Thank you.
Great insight. So it's so funny that... And I'm sure you know this word, Brashirt, right?
Yeah.
Okay, well, that was what my comment was to your producer. It was my father's last breath on his dying bed was inhaled by me. I mean, I felt a rush of air as he was passing that went right through me, that I physically felt it go in me, as you were saying about the breathologist in India. So his passing was... marked by that.
So a form of immortality, if by nothing more than the passing of his breath to your lungs.
Exactly. Physically felt.
Wow.
Physically sensed it.
Wow.
So and now that you just, he just discussed that with the Indian, you know, in India, that the breathologist, and then you just took my call. Strange, huh?
A powerful story, yes.
But you can tell Brian what Brashirt means in the Yiddish language.
Oh yeah. Oh yeah.
What is it?
Alan, thank you for your call.
Well, all right.
It's like right. I'm thinking about that call, and is it immortality? I mean, I'm sure it was an incredibly beautiful spiritual moment between he and his dad.
I mean, you could say that another example of how his breath passed into him happened at the moment of conception as well. I mean, of course, there's a part of his father living on in him, just as there's a part of all of his ancestors before him living on in him as well. I think that is a beautiful story about what happens at death.
How about Judy in Westbury? You're on WNYC. Hi, Judy.
Hi, Ryan. I have to say I love your show before anything.
Thank you.
And about the topic, there's many things to say. The last caller just impressed me with he said that his father said immortality is when he passed from his dad to his son. But what I wanted to say is that we are all immortal, spiritually, though. We live forever, and not necessarily physically. Physically, we can last longer than we do today if we want to, if we know how to control our thoughts and think more positively. But this is pretty much my thought. I'm really interested in getting that book that your author has there. It's very interesting.
Thank you very much, which, by the way, is called, as we begin to run out of time, The Book of Immortality, The Science, Belief, and Magic Behind Living Forever by Adam Leith Gollner, who's a former editor of Vice magazine. Do you want to say anything to her comment?
Yeah, I think that it's an interesting comment again. You know, she's speaking about her certainty about spiritual immortality. And I think that's something I encountered over and over and over again interviewing these spiritual leaders, whether it was Jesuit priests or Hasidic rabbis or Sufi imams. All of them had this certainty that there's more to come.
And so did you wind up with this sense of that it's bereshit, that it's fated, that you're going to live forever now that you've researched this book?
All I've got is uncertainty.
Thanks a lot, Lo.
Thank you.